There are, that's, actually I want to make a theological point about that here in a minute. Not about you, Paige, but recognizing people that are hard to see sometimes. Lots of people working to put this on. You know, you see people moving around, cleaning things and getting food set up and audiovisual stuff. And so we're going to talk a little bit about that today. Anyway, welcome back. Some of you, welcome back to the holding of the seat session for Walter Brueggemann, which will begin at 2:30. I made a joke about that yesterday, that it was so packed on, was it Wednesday? It was so packed on Wednesday that some people came early and listened to the presentation. And some of you were so kind to actually confess to that. You said, I actually was there just to hold a seat. And surprise, you were surprisingly okay. You were, who knew? And so, anyway, that's pretty funny. I think that's pretty awesome. So I benefited by that. So thanks to Mike Cope for letting that happen. So, but yeah, the Walter Brueggemann crowd's going to be coming in here. So again, I gave everybody yesterday permission to go to the bathroom during the presentation. So you don't have to do it in the middle. I mean, so you don't have to do it at the end, because there will be a line back there when we're done. You'll get up and I'll turn around and they'll be there like vultures looking for your seat. And so I please get up and go to the restroom during the presentation. So anyway, my name is Richard Beck, and I am the chair of the psychology department at Abilene Christian University. And this is our 1:30 therapy session. So we're going to start going around your name while you're here, and we'll have our session. If you were not here yesterday, let me quickly kind of catch you up. Yesterday I kind of talked about hospitality and welcoming others as an affectional capacity, that we are asked to follow a teacher that eats with tax collectors and sinners, but we see the church fail in that call. Very obvious thing that we're supposed to do, yet we struggle a great deal with it. And some argument yesterday, for those of you who were here, was one of the reasons why we fail in that is it's not really a rational failure. It is a failure of our affections. And rather than leaning in to the discomfort of welcoming tax collectors and sinners, we have a tendency to lean away. And that tendency is more affectional. And so how do we reshape and reform our hearts? That's what I want to talk a little bit about today. Before I do that, though, I would like to talk about, as a psychologist, two disorders that I think I've discovered coming to Pepperdine. Do you know what they involve? They involve this. My wife and I, so I went online, and apparently bathmophobia is the fear of stairs or slopes, and that's true. And then relatedly, as I was researching, this is climacophobia, which is the fear of climbing, related to the fear of stairs. That's legit. Like, I swear to you today, I approached some steps and went, you know what, I can't do it anymore. like, there's got to be another session on this level, because I ain't doing it. I'm not kidding you. I turned away from a session because there were stairs. I couldn't do it. I was like, I felt, I'm going to go back to ACU. I'm going to be like shaking, PTSD symptoms, you know, because of the trauma of the stairs. I'm in West Texas, right? There is no altitude at all. I mean, I live in a very Euclidean place. And this, you know, last year I was telling Jana, I said, I was late. I was trying to get to something in the cafeteria building, and I saw this huge parking lot right next to it, like on the map. And I parked, and it was right next to it, but the altitude distance was like, it's that parking lot down by the field house. Like, you ever climb that thing? Anybody ever climb that thing in the dark? That's a sketchy, you're like, I can be murdered out here, and nobody would know. Like 3 months later, they just find bones in this thing, and like, I don't know where we lost them. And last saw them at the field house, and they're making their way up to the cafeteria and never saw them again. You know, they need Sherpas down there is what they need to do. Except for they've revolted. The Sherpas at Everest because of that thing. So anyway, That has nothing really to do with this presentation at all, so let's move on to what we want to talk about here. I want to talk about, okay, so if hospitality is an affectional capacity, how is it that we remake the heart? Because that's not going to be a pedagogical activity. That's a fancy word for teaching. This is not a cerebral activity. I just can't teach you a class, and you can't preach a sermon or hand a book to somebody and say, this will soften your heart towards people that you have a tough time. So what do you do? How do you soften up a heart? By the way, let me give you a quick resource. If everything I say this afternoon is not worth your time, at least you get a good book recommendation here. And so I think one of the best books I've read in a long time is James Smith's Desiring the Kingdom. Has anyone read Desiring the Kingdom? It is a fantastic book, I think, because his argument is that Christian spiritual formation has been way too cerebral. It's really a book about the Christian university, but it really does have applications, I think, for the church. And his argument is that he flips Rene Descartes on his head, saying it's not I think, therefore I am, but rather we are what we love. And so he has this anthropology, this psychology that focuses on love. And our loves, you know, like St. Augustine talks about, our loves are all good, they're just disordered. You know, they're just aimed at the wrong things. And so he sees us fundamentally as lovers. And then the question is, okay, if spiritual practice and formation is to teach us to love correctly, and so that's kind of my point of bringing it in here, teach us to shape our affections, that's going to be hard to do from the top, from the head down to the heart. And so you have to start practicing habits. And so this is going to be kind of a class about how you might acquire new kind of habits, and that the habits of what we're going to talk about will reshape your affections. And so, and this is really an autobiographical story, because I wrote a book called Unclean, which talks about a lot of these kinds of things, and then people wanted me to kind of talk about the book, and they would say things like, so what are you doing to live a more hospitable life? And I said, I'm an academic. I'm just a theoretician. I don't really do any of this. And so they were like, wow, okay. So I started needing to live into this lifestyle. And so I was thinking, okay, I need to get some new friends then. And if you know the faculty at ACU, you know why I need new friends. Those are unpleasant people, my colleagues. I mean, I know out here in Malibu they seem really smart, but if you live with them day to day, they're not pleasant people. So I needed new friends. And so I was looking for a place to spend time, and so I started volunteering out at a prison. So that's how I started, I mean, literally trying to live, practice this book. I needed to, you know, Matthew 25, visit the prisoner. I'll begin there. And so I started doing that. It was really profound. I loved doing it. It's one of the highlights of my week on Monday, being out of the prison. And then Jana pushed me a little further. My wife, if she's in here, I don't really enjoy her either, because she says things like this to me. And she goes, you know, you're the only person I know that can reach out to people and welcome people that can't follow you home at the end of the night. But like the prisoners can't. She didn't say that meanly. Like, that's true. They are locked up. They can't call me. They can't. See you guys. You know, it's been good. So it's very clean. They can't mess with my life. And so I had to kind of keep going deeper into these practices. And now my life has gotten messier because now I'm friends with people that can interfere and mess with my life a little bit. And so this is kind of my story as well. So where does my story begin? It began with this saint behind me, Saint Therese of Lisieux. Those of you who follow me online know that she's become an important saint. And I just want to talk about my biography with what is called the Little Way of Saint Therese of Lisieux. Very quickly, I discovered her because when you start writing about hospitality, you quickly come across people like Dorothy Day and her Houses of Hospitality, the Catholic Worker Movement. And so I am a huge Dorothy Day fan, and her witness is amazing. And so, but then I've discovered that Dorothy Day considered herself a follower of Therese of Lisieux. And then I've discovered like people like Thomas Merton were followers of Therese of Lisieux. I eventually found out that Mother Teresa of Calcutta took her name after Therese of Lisieux. And I said, well, that's a pretty good resume right there. Dorothy Day, Thomas Merton, Mother Teresa of Calcutta. What is it about this Catholic saint? And here's the weird thing about her story. The weird thing about her story is she grew up in a very religious family. This is in the 1800s. grew up in a religious family, wanted to go. Her sister, two older sisters, went into the Carmelite monastery or convent. She wanted to go in early. They had to wait till she was 16. She appealed to the Pope. The Pope listened to her, let her go in early. She goes in at 15, and she dies when I think she's 21, 22. Wakes up on Good Friday, coughing in the middle of the night, feels liquid on her mouth, wakes up in the morning, and the liquid is revealed to be blood. And after about almost 2 years' worth of very painful, because she has tuberculosis, painful experience, eventually dies, age of like 22. And never left the monastery, like just never left. And outwardly did nothing of distinction. In fact, it was said upon the time of her death, sisters looked around and said, man, what are we going to say at her funeral? That's just how undistinctive her life was. Very nice, very, very kind, but didn't seem to have anything that really kind of made her stand out. And then within a couple years, became one of the most beloved saints within the Catholic tradition. She's called the Little Flower. And the reason why is she wrote a book called Story of a Soul. And inside the book of A Story of a Soul, she tells about this desire to do great and radical things for Jesus. She wanted to, like, die as a martyr on the mission field. But she's in a convent. And she wanted to be a priest. But she's a woman. And she just found herself just doing the day-to-day grind that we all do, right? You get up, you make your coffee, you go to work, you same old people every day. I mean, very similar to her convent. I'm seeing the same old sister. We're doing the same old things. We're saying our prayers. We're washing our clothes. And a day passes, and it doesn't seem very heroic or radical, you know? And we feel that thirst, don't we? We want to do something radical and awesome for Jesus. And so she started trying to figure out a path towards this heroic service for Jesus. And she figured out a way that's called the Little Way. Mother Teresa describes the Little Way as this. We cannot do great things, right? But we can do little things with great love. And so the Little Way is, Thomas Merton describes the Little Way as this. He called it kind of the democratization of holiness, the democratization of saintliness. And it showed a way that even, because saints used to be the big superheroes of the faith, but Therese showed a way that somebody who's just, you know, working in the checkout line of Walmart could be like a spiritual radical. You know, she'd figured out a way to do the radical thing in the mundane. And that's why the little way is so kind of beloved, because it shows how anybody could be radical. It sounds little, but the more I describe it, you'll realize what she's asking us to do is pretty hard to do. And so I'm going to try to unpack in my vision of what the little way is all about. In my own life. I'm going to begin with, this is the way I'm going to unpack the little way for us. I'm going to break the little way down into these components. I might not get to all of them, but I'm going to try to here. This is Therese in her Story of a Soul. She says, as she looked at her convent, she said, you know, I've noticed this, she writes, and this is very natural, that the most saintly sisters are the most loved. You know, the most well-adjusted, the attractive, the pop, you know, think about your church, your workplace. They are the most loved, right? They're easy to love. And we seek out their company. We render these people services without their even asking. And finally, these souls, so capable of bearing with the lack of respect and consideration of others, see themselves surrounded by everybody's affection. The rich get richer socially. Remember yesterday we were talking about the inept and the hard to love, The popular people just are surrounded by all this affection. But she says, but on the other hand, imperfect souls are not sought out. Now, no doubt we remain within the limits of religious politeness in their regard, but we generally avoid them, lest we say something that isn't too admirable. And so then he goes on, when I speak of imperfect souls, I'm speaking of a certain lack of judgment, good manners, a touchiness in certain characters, all these things that make life not agreeable. You got people, and you're like, yeah, Uncle Joe, that's going to, you know, lack of good manners, touchiness of character, you know. She goes, I know very well that these moral infirmities are chronic and that there is no hope of a cure. And they're just the way they are. That's not going to get fixed, what irritates me about them. But she says, goes on and says this, but I know that my mother would not cease to take care of me or try to console me if I was sick my entire life. And so she realized that these aren't going to get better. These people, but I'm going to figure out a way to deal with the most disagreeable sisters in my convert by practicing this thing called the little way. So where does it begin? I'm going to argue it begins with attention. And I know I'm running out of time, but I want to actually show you a video clip here. Of what I think attention is. From David Foster Wallace's Kenyon College commencement address, which eventually got published as a little book called This Is Water. And it was eventually animated. And even though this is not me talking, it's worth seeing. Has anybody seen this before? If you've never seen it, I think it's life-changing. Like, I regularly watch it over and over and over again. But it's going to illustrate attention. This was to college graduates, but I think he's describing the church. And I want you to pay attention specifically for my purposes to the guy in the supermarket standing in line and how he's just being inhospitable and judgmental of everybody around him. But if he could pay attention to what's happening, then a whole other soft-hearted hospitality begins opening up. This is the little way. It is practiced like in things like standing in a line. Okay? It's a little thing. How well do you stand in a line? Like, did you stand in line well today? You could be practicing this radical stuff in a line, in traffic. That's where the radical part comes in. Like, really? I have to be patient in a line? Yes. Watch and learn, people. Watch and learn. Here we go. David Foster Wallace, This Is Water.
There are these two young fish swimming along, and they happen to meet an older fish swimming the other way, who nods at them and says, "Morning, boys, how's the water?" And the two young fish swim on for a bit, and then looks over at the other and goes, "What the hell is water?" The point of the fish story is merely that the most obvious, important realities are often the ones that are hardest to see and talk about. Stated as an English sentence, of course, this is just a banal platitude. But the fact is that in the day-to-day trenches of adult existence, banal platitudes can have a life-or-death importance. The plain fact is that you graduating seniors do not yet have any clue what day-in, day-out really means. There happen to be whole, large parts of adult American life that nobody talks about in commencement speeches. One such part involves boredom, routine, and petty frustration. The parents and older folks here will know all too well what I'm talking about. By way of example, let's say it's an average adult day, and you get up in the morning, go to your challenging white-collar college graduate job, and you work hard for 8 or 10 hours, and at the end of the day you're tired and somewhat stressed, and all you want is to go home and have a good supper and maybe unwind for an hour and then hit the sack early, because of course you have to get up the next day and do it all again. Then you remember there's no food at home. You haven't had time to shop this week because of your challenging job. And so now, after work, you have to get in your car and drive to the supermarket. It's the end of a work day, and the traffic is apt to be very bad. So getting to the store takes way longer than it should. And when you finally get there, the supermarket is very crowded because, of course, it's the time of day when all the other people with jobs also try to squeeze in some grocery shopping. But you can't just get in and quickly out. You have to wander all over the huge, overlit store's confusing aisles to find the stuff you want. And you have to maneuver your junky cart through all these other tired, hurried people with carts, et cetera, cutting stuff out because it's a long ceremony. And eventually, you get all your supper supplies, except now it turns out there aren't enough checkout lanes open, even though it's the end of the day rush. So the checkout line is incredibly long, which is stupid and infuriating. But you can't take your frustration out on the frantic lady working the register, who is overworked at a job whose daily tedium and meaninglessness surpasses the imagination of any of us here at a prestigious college. But anyway, you finally get to the checkout line's front, and you pay for your food, and get told to have a nice day in a voice that is the absolute voice of death. And then you have to take your creepy, flimsy plastic bags of groceries in your cart with the one crazy wheel that pulls maddeningly to the left, all the way out through the crowded, bumpy, littery parking lot, and then you have to drive all the way home through slow, heavy, SUV-intensive rush hour traffic, et cetera, et cetera. Everyone here has done this, of course, but it hasn't yet been part of you graduates' actual life routine, day after week, after month, after year. But it will be. And many more dreary, annoying, seemingly meaningless routines besides. But that is not the point. The point is that petty, frustrating crap like this is exactly where the work of choosing is going to come in. Because the traffic jams and crowded aisles and long checkout lines give me time to think. And if I don't make a conscious decision about how to think and what to pay attention to, I'm going to be pissed and miserable every time I have to shop. Because my natural default setting is the certainty that situations like this are really all about me. About my hungriness and my fatigue and my desire to just get home. And it's going to seem, for all the world, like everybody else is just in my way. And who are all these people in my way? And look at how repulsive most of them are and how stupid and cow-like and dead-eyed and non-human they seem in the checkout line. Or at how annoying and rude it is that people are talking loudly on cell phones in the middle of the line. And look at how deeply, personally unfair this is. If I choose to think this way in the store and on the freeway, fine. Lots of us do. Except thinking this way tends to be so easy and automatic that it doesn't have to be a choice. It is my natural default setting. It's the automatic way that I experience the boring, frustrating, crowded parts of adult life when I'm operating on the automatic, unconscious belief that I am the center of the world and that my immediate needs and feelings are what should determine the world's priorities. The thing is that, of course, there are totally different ways to think about these kinds of situations. In this traffic, all these vehicles stuck and idling in my way, it's not impossible that some of these people in SUVs have been in horrible auto accidents in the past and now find driving so terrifying that their therapist has all but ordered them to get a huge, heavy SUV so they can feel safe enough to drive. Or I can choose to force myself to consider the likelihood that everyone else in the supermarket's checkout line is just as bored and frustrated as I am, and that some of these people probably have much harder, more tedious, or painful lives than I do. Again, please don't think I'm giving you moral advice or that I'm saying you're supposed to think this way or that anyone expects you to just automatically do it, because it's hard. It takes will and effort. And if you are like me, some days you won't be able to do it or you just flat out won't want to. But most days, if you're aware enough to give yourself a choice, you can choose to look differently at this fat, dead-eyed, over-made-up lady who just screamed at her kid in the checkout line. Maybe she's not usually like this. Maybe she's been up 3 straight nights holding the hand of her husband who's dying of bone cancer. Or maybe this very lady is the low-wage clerk at the motor vehicles department who just yesterday helped your spouse resolve a horrific, infuriating red tape problem through some small act of bureaucratic kindness. Of course, none of this is likely, but it's also not impossible. It just depends what you want to consider. If you're automatically sure that you know what reality is and who and what is really important, if you want to operate on your default setting, then you, like me, probably won't consider possibilities that aren't annoying and miserable. But if you've really learned how to think, how to pay attention, then you will know you have other options. It will actually be within your power to experience a crowded, hot, slow, consumer hell-type situation as not only meaningful, but sacred, on fire with the same force that lit the stars. Love, fellowship, the mystical oneness of all things deep down. Not that that mystical stuff's necessarily true. The only thing that's capital T true is that you get to decide how you're going to try to see it. This, I submit, is the freedom of real education, of learning how to be well-adjusted. You get to consciously decide what has meaning and what doesn't. That is real freedom. That is being educated and understanding how to think. The alternative is unconsciousness, the default setting, the rat race, the constant gnawing sense of having had and lost some infinite thing. I know that this stuff probably doesn't sound fun and breezy or grandly inspirational the way a commencement speech is supposed to sound. What it is, as far as I can see, is the capital T truth with a whole lot of rhetorical niceties stripped away. You are, of course, free to think of it whatever you wish. but please don't just dismiss it as some finger-wagging Dr. Laura sermon. None of this stuff is really about morality or religion or dogma or big fancy questions of life after death. The capital T truth is about life before death. It is about the real value of a real education, which has almost nothing to do with knowledge and everything to do with simple awareness. Awareness of what is so real and essential, so hidden in plain sight all around us all the time, that we have to keep reminding ourselves over and over, this is water. This is water.
It's worth it, right? So, yeah. In the story of a soul, Therese has she's in the chapel saying the psalms, right? And she tells the story about there's a sister in front of her making this annoying clicking sound, and it's just driving her crazy. She cannot concentrate on the psalms because the click, and you guys know what that's like, right? Just like the mere fact that the way your spouse is eating their cereal, you're like, that bothers me. I don't know why it is, but the slurping, it's getting on my nerves. Have you ever been annoyed just by somebody's chewing? And you know it's just you're just being irritable, you know? And it's just, in the little way is learning how to pay attention and master that irritation that we have. It begins there with that self-overcoming. Now you start realizing how heroic this is. Like if I just sent you out of there and said, work on that for three months, you have plenty to work on. But we're going to go a little deeper. Seeing. Can you see people? This goes to my comment about seeing the AV people. I talked to my students about what Peter Singer calls the moral circle. And Singer says, in the moral circle, there are two kinds of people in the world. There's people that are inside our moral circle, the people that we recognize as our friends, our family, our brothers, our sisters. They're in my side. And in that circle, we extend kindness to them. In fact, the root of kindness is kin. It's the affection we share to kin. Kindness is family affection. But then people outside the moral circle are strangers, and we treat them instrumentally as objects in our world. They're just in our way, to use his term. Can we see people outside our moral circle? So I illustrate this with my students. I say, you know, imagine your best friend gets a job waiting tables at a restaurant in town. And you say, great, you know, you're going to be on your first shift, your own tables. We're going to come, and you can wait on us, and it'll be fun. And so you go out, and your friend gets to the table, you know, first night on the floor, and they're just sweating. They're like bullets. Anybody work food and beverage? It's a hellhole, that industry. I mean, it's awful. And there are days when you're just in the weeds, as they say. And so they are in the weeds, your friend is. And they're sweating, and they're like, the night is going horrible. It's bad, and I'm behind. And so I tell my students, what do you do to your friend? What do you say to them? What do you say? You guys are well-adjusted people, right? You're Christians. What would you say to your friend? Don't worry about us. Take care of everybody else. Get to us when you can get us, right? And Jesus says in the Sermon on the Mount, that is no great moral demonstration. Even the pagans do that. That's the way you treat your friends and your family, because she's in your moral circle. But tonight, many of us will go out to eat, and we'll be vaguely aware that there's a person by my table who's stressed out and the service is not as good as whatever, and we're just going to get kind of frustrated. And you start noticing the process of dehumanization begin when you stop making eye contact. They start asking how things are, and you won't even look at them. You just kind of look down and go, well, you know what I mean? You know how it does it. You slowly begin. And here's the thing. I tell the students, why do you treat those two people differently? Because one is a friend and one is a stranger. One is inside the moral circle, and they're given a level of behavior, affection, that the other person is not. You don't see the other person as a human being. We talked about that yesterday. They're just in your way. They're a tool. They're an instrument, and they're broken. And so Jesus, I think, is calling us to live in a world where there are no strangers, where God shows up always as the stranger. And we're trying to expand the moral circle, where this kindness is extended to everybody in the world. But you have to see them first. Can you see people? Some of us are going to be flying back. And have you ever been there? I mean, flying is horrible. And you've been there, and like they cancel the flight, or things have changed, and people got to now get their vouchers for the hotel, and it's just awful, right? And that there's going to be a line at the ticket desk, and that, you know, American Airlines ticket lady is going to be brutalized for the next hour. You've seen it, right? How many of you guys have seen this? She's going to deal with one angry customer after another. Can you see her? That's the little way. can you see her and say, when I approach this desk, she's been getting crap from everybody. And listen, I'm mad too, because I want to go home and see my kids as well. But it's not her fault. And in the 5 minutes, I will stand in front of her. That'll be protected. And you'll get up and go, how's the night going? And she'll be like, oh. And you can create a human interaction in the middle of this situation. And some of you guys do that. You try, you know, the best person in my life that does it, Jana, my wife Jana, she can humanize these capitalistic, impersonal, stranger dealing with stranger situations. Can you see people? This is the craziest thing I try to do in my department is at night, ACU hires a cleaning service. They come in and clean at night, you know, and mainly those are Hispanic women that are hired by a company. And we never see them, you know. So my students, fairly middle to upper class students, apparently the toilets clean themselves at ACU. Pixies come in at night and clean, wipe our urine off the toilets and empty our trash. It's magic, you know. And can we see those people? And so what we started doing at Christmas time, I call the company. I say, I want to know the name of the lady that cleans this building this semester. And we get her name, and then we go around and say, by the way, Maria is the one that's cleaned our toilet. She's taking our trash out. We're taking up a collection for her, get her a Christmas present, you know, gift card to Walmart or something like that. Can you see her? So I think if I do anything at ACU, I mean, okay, I can talk about psychology. But if I can get them, they're going to go out in the world, can they see the people that take out the trash? That's what I'm talking about. That's why you try to send your students to ACU. Pepperdine, who knows what they do here. But, I mean, ACU, you know, is a place where Christians are formed. Anyway, I'm just joking about that. And then I tried to go even further. This is where I crossed the line with my faculty. So I wanted to kind of ramp it up, you know. And I said, here's what we're going to do, faculty. This is my idea. What we're going to do to help them see the work that's being done in the world that they tend not to see, we are going to buy cleaning supplies, and the faculty and the students will clean our own bathrooms together. And we'll sign up. And so Dr. Beck will have it on Mondays. And then Sally, a student, a sophomore, will do it on Tuesdays. And Dr. Mack will know that you'll be on. And they were looking at me like, you are crazy. You know, I am a faculty member. I'm not cleaning toilets. And I'm like, but wouldn't Jesus, you know, wouldn't Jesus be cleaning the toilets? And I'm like legit, you know, I'm it did. So anyway, this is why my faculty don't listen to me. I have ideas like that. So faculty meeting goes, you get my point, though? I'm not saying that was a great idea, because they was like, well, if we're cleaning the bathroom, she doesn't need the job. Anyway, like, oh, that's complicated. But anyway, my point is, can you see the people that do that work, you know, all around you? Can you see people? So that's seeing, which is a form of attention. The next one is approaching. This is the hard one. That's been the easy stuff. Here's the hard one, approaching. This is what Therese says in A Story of a Soul. So she's talked about these imperfect souls that make life disagreeable. So I want you to think of that person at your workplace, the most disagreeable person at your work, or think about the most disagreeable person at your church. She says this is the conclusion I draw from this, that I must seek out in recreation and on my free days the company of the sisters who are least agreeable. To me, the least agreeable to me, in order to do this, this is interesting. She goes, in order to carry out with regard to these souls, these wounded souls, the office of the Good Samaritan. Approaching these wounded souls, socially crippled or inept, she calls it being a Good Samaritan. And then she goes on, a word, an amiable smile often suffice to make a sad soul bloom. It's a little thing. A word, a smile, how are you doing? Approach and say, how are you doing? So she says, I want to be friendly with everybody, and especially to the least amiable sisters, to give joy to Jesus. She goes on, loving your enemies, right? That seems heroic. Turn the other cheek, love your enemies. She says this, no doubt we don't have enemies at Carmel, but there are feelings. There's one of the best lines in the whole book. I liked it. I don't really have enemies at church, but there are feelings. Lots and lots of feelings. isn't there? There are feelings. I would say I'm an enemy with them, but I don't like them, you know. There are feelings. One feels attracted to this sister, whereas with regard to another, we talked about this yesterday, in regard to this other one, I would make a long detour to avoid meeting her. And so, without knowing it, she becomes a subject of persecution. Well, she says, Jesus is telling me that it is this sister who must be loved. So the little way is not just learning to master irritations and keeping the humanity of everybody in that line firmly in view. It's learning to see the people all around you, to see the lady that's going to have to deal with all these angry customers, to see the person checking you out at Walmart. But it's also then approaching, intentionally finding somebody. Lots of people say, you paint this big picture of hospitality and the radical welcome of God. It's all big. So where do we begin? People ask me that. Where do we begin, Dr. Bryce? There's one person in your life on Monday morning that you can approach with a howdy or a hi or how's your weekend. Begin there. Begin there. Don't try to save the world. You know, try to begin there. Approach somebody. And so, and it will mess your life up. So I was in my church, and I stood there looking at my church, and I said to myself, what is the one person I probably wouldn't really just be completely drawn to? And so I looked in the back, and there was Christy. And Christy, for those of you who go to Highland, you guys know Christy, but Christy's in a wheelchair, and she's blind, so she has big glasses, big sunglasses on, and she, because of a tumor, I found out, and she has lost facial movement. She's has facial paralysis, so she can't smile. And if you have glasses in your wheelchair and you can't smile, you look kind of, you know, you don't look approachable, you know, aesthetically speaking. And I said, I'm not really gut drawn to Christy. I'm awkward. It's a handicapped, blind person. She doesn't smile. I'll begin there. I'll start welcoming one person. So Jana knows, I just made it my mission that no matter what I did on Sunday, I would approach and say hello. And eventually over time, I kept talking to Christy, get to know her name, and then I said, you know, hey, Christy, you always sit here in the back. Like, do you like sitting in the back? Well, you know, why are you in the back? She goes, well, that's just, you know, when the bus picks me up from church, that's where they put me, you know, back here. And because Highland seating is terrible. And so I said, do you like sitting back here by yourself? She goes, no, because sometimes when church gets out, people step on my feet and stuff like that. I'm like, yeah, right. You know, way to go to church. You know, let's just put the blind girl on the back and step on her feet. Like, welcome to. I'm like, this is terrible. I said, that's awful. And I said, would you like to sit with somebody? She goes, yeah. I go, so I got, you guys may know Dickie Porsche. So I got with Dickie Porsche, kind of our administrative. Where I said, Dickie, Christy, we're not going to put her in the back. We're going to find a place for her. So we figured out a place and on a row where she could wheel the wheelchair right up next to us. So Christy sits with the Beck family now. And unfortunately, Dickie reserved this row. This is reserved for the Beck family. That's what he wrote on it. And it's always there. So people, all my friends are like, so why do you get a reserved row? You know? They're like constantly asking us. I'm like, I don't want to answer it. But then I get angry. And I said, because we're sitting with handicapped people and you're not. So you're going to hell. And like, I have a reserve row because I'm like Jesus, and you're not, right? So there you go. Like, so I don't really escalate to that degree. But, again, there are feelings at Highland, and they come out. I'm kidding. It's been a really awkward time to explain why. Because you don't want to say that. You don't like, anyway, don't let your right hand know what the left hand's doing. So, but anyway, that's. But anyway, all I have to say is Christy's now a part of my life. Like, Christy will call me. She could probably call me in the middle of this presentation now. And when it was my birthday, she lives in a halfway house with a lot of many disabled people. And so Janice said, what do you want to do for your birthday? And I said, I want to take my cake over there. And we had cake over there at Christy's. And I came home, and I love my wife. I came home, and she had made this beautiful picnic basket, and it was a pound cake. And we went over there and, you know, and have my birthday party over there. I'm just telling you all that, not to tell you that I'm an amazing person, because that's a little thing, right? It just started with me just approaching one person, and then a relationship forms, and now all of a sudden, you know, I'm having my birthday party at a house that has handicapped people, in it. And that's what can happen here with a little thing. It gets bigger and it gets bigger. And those of you that have been practicing this and could be my mentors, you know how messy your life can get. When you start introducing people into your life, when you start giving them your phone number, and they call you all the time at night, things like that. It begins with a simple approaching here. Interruptibility. I got two more. Interruptibility. This is another practice that you can work on. I think one of the two most profound words in all of Scripture are when the blind man's calling out to Jesus, "Son of David, you know, have mercy on me. Son of David, have mercy on me." Everybody's telling him, "Shut up, shut up." He calls out louder. And what does the gospel says? Two profound words. Jesus stopped. I love that. So much of our Christian practice hinges upon that. Are you a person that stops? We're so busy, we don't stop. In a famous study in psychology by Batson and Darby, it's called the Good Samaritan Study. They did this study with lots of seminarians, people going to the ministry. And they told half of them, you're going to be preaching. Like, if you guys are in the study, you guys are going to be preaching a sermon for your sermon class on the Sermon of the Good Samaritan. You all are going to preach on, you know, Zacchaeus, all right? So you're all preparing. And then they send them to a room, and then they do another manipulation. And they tell this group on the front, both sides, that the venue's been changed, and you got to get on over there because it's starting very soon. So they send you out the door in what they call the high hurry condition. So they put you under time pressure. And then the back half, you all are told, because of the venue change, you have plenty of time, like an hour or two, to get over there. So that's the low hurry manipulation. So the question was, they wanted to know, who would stop? Because outside the door, they had somebody in like abdominal distress. Somebody needing some, perhaps, medical attention. An actor, but didn't know. And they sent them out the door, and they were seeing who would just kind of go over and say, "Are you okay? Can I call or get you something?" That's all they were measuring. So they send people out, and they had these hypotheses. Who stops? They will all stop because they're all going into the ministry. That hypothesis was not correct. Maybe you all would stop because you've been primed to be thinking about the Good Samaritan. Like, it's on your mind. You know, you're passing by somebody on the side of the road, and you're like, this is vaguely familiar. Like I should, I don't know what that is. Deja vu. So maybe it was the priming. Like, if I prime you and you've been thinking about it, you're going to do a sermon on the Good Samaritan, you'd be more like the Good Samaritan. Or maybe it was time. And if you guys know this study, you can see where this is going, right? The number one predictor of who stopped was those who had the time to do it. And this is where I stick it to my students to make them feel guilty. I tell them, I say, "You know what that tells me about Christianity?" And go, "What?" I said, "It's because most people, that tells me, that study, most people practice their Christianity as a hobby. Most Christians are hobbyists. Why? Why do I say that? When you do your hobbies, when you have the time. If you don't have time, you know, Jesus is a hobby for most of us. We do it on the weekends. If it interrupts us, we don't do it. It tells you where your priorities are. So interruptibility, and you guys know how hard that is to be interrupted is probably one of the most, particularly in America, one of the most gracious acts of welcome that we can have, to allow their needs to trump my agenda and my needs. And I know that's hard, but that's another practice of the little way. Mastering your irritation and your need to rush off. And so I was joking yesterday about trying to exit the door. Remember that? Somebody's trying to, I'm trying to learn to not head through the door and stay planted. And literally, a part of my practice a little way is learning to orient my body directly face on and hold it because everything is wanting to turn. You guys have done that? Just fight it. Stand there square and attend is a huge spiritual discipline. I don't know what you did for Lent, but just standing square and listening to people, begin there, you know. And our last one is, we're going to be 1 minute to do this one, but honoring. In unclean, I talk about the divisions in the body in this text in Corinth. Lots of people, when they hear the body metaphor, the body has many parts. And a lot of times when we read that, we all want to know, like, what part of the body am I? And what spiritual gift do I have? You know, we all want to know, we're so narcissistic, we want to know, what am I good at? You know, and we take gifts, inventories, and figure it all out. But if you look at the body metaphor, the issue of the body metaphor wasn't that people were different. That wasn't the point of the metaphor. What was the point of the metaphor? point of the metaphor was that people are different and their gifts were being honored and shamed differently. It's not the fact that we're all different, you're an eye and I'm a foot. It's that the foot is disgusting and less elevated. How do I know that? It's in the Bible. Right at the end of the metaphor, it says this. The eye can't say to the hand, I don't need you. And it's not that we all need each other. That's not the point. You know with me? This isn't a point that we all need each other. This is about shaming people. On the contrary, those parts of the body seem to be weaker and are indispensable. And the parts that we think are less honorable, this is the point of the whole metaphor. And you know what he talks about right after this chapter? Love. This is the lead into the big love chapter. It's the way people are treating each other and the way they're shaming each other. The parts that we think are less honorable, we treat with special honor. There are parts of the church that are being shamed, and we're trying to elevate them, rehabilitate them with special honoring. The parts that are unpresentable, and that's a reference to genitalia. There are shameful parts that we want to hide away. We don't want to see them on the stage. We don't want to recognize them. We want to push them back in the wheelchair and along the back wall. The parts that are unpresentable, and they're treated with special modesty, right? We clothe them. And he flips this. He says, I know you think you're covering up those parts of the body because they're shameful. But he says, but what we're doing is giving them special treatment. And our presentable parts need the talented one, the beautiful one. They don't need anything special. Like Thérèse of Lisieux, right? Those sisters, they don't need any additional. But what does God do? He puts the body together. Not in their diversity, but in their equal honoring, giving greater honor to the parts that lack it. That's church, in giving greater honor to the parts that lacked it, so that there will be no division in the body. The divisions of the body are not doctrinal. They're shaming issues. They are the way we lift up this and say, this is great and spectacular. But these things, these people in our churches are never seen. They never make the stage. They never lead the prayer. They're never up front. And so that's another way of welcoming hospitality. So how does your church, through its practices, honor and shame? What is unpresentable? And do you give it greater honor? That's the way you deal with division in the church. By giving greater honor to the parts that lack it. And seeing those people the way I saw Christy along the back wall one day. I am now out of time. Thank you guys for coming. Again, Walter Brueggemann will be here shortly. So thank you for being here.